You are widely regarded as one of the leading philosophers of the mind. Why do you keep coming back to questions about consciousness, a subject you've now been studying for decades?
Well, for me, consciousness poses just about the most interesting unsolved problems in the world. I mean, I came at this from a background in science and mathematics, and I was looking... there was a sense that, okay, although physics and mathematics are still exciting today, there was a sense they were more exciting a few hundred years ago when everything was unknown. And it just struck me that the problem right now that stands out as being unknown, unsolved, in the way that, you know, problems, say, in the foundations of physics were a few hundred years ago, are problems of the mind, and in particular the problem of consciousness. How is it that physical processes in a brain give you conscious experience? It's just always fascinated me.
So you're saying the science of the mind is perhaps the last great unanswered question in science, maybe in philosophy too?
Maybe the last great. I mean, there's lots of small unanswered questions and even pretty big ones. But if you want to go for a place where we really don't have a clue, or where there's still just a really enormous mystery at the very heart of the issue, I think it's in the problems of the mind, and in particular the... You know, it's an ancient philosophical problem, the mind-body problem. What's the relationship between mind and body? And in its contemporary guise, it's really turned into the consciousness-brain problem. What's the relationship between the brain and consciousness? And we're still just coming to grips with that one.
Now, if you talk to brain scientists, most will say it's just a matter of time before science unlocks the mysteries of the mind. And they usually say neuroscience is the path to do this. I mean, this is the discipline that will crack the puzzle of consciousness. What do you think?
Well, I think it's reasonable to think that brain science and neuroscience is going to be a huge component of whatever the ultimate solution is. But I think it's also, if you talk to, you know, some of those brain scientists, maybe late at night, off the record, I think you'll find that there's about as big a diversity of opinion among brain scientists about the problem of consciousness as there is among philosophers. That is, almost everyone will recognize that, at least right now, we're not even close to a solution. And maybe the division is between those who think that, well, if we just eventually keep doing it and something, we'll come across something and that'll be the key to the solution. And people who think, well, no, we need to be doing something fundamentally different from what we're doing now to get to consciousness. I mean, the basic worry is that if we're dealing with questions of explaining, say, behavior from the third person point of view, then it looks like the brain approach is pretty good. Treat the mind as a giant computer and see what it gives rise to. But if we're interested in the problems of consciousness from the first person point of view, there's just this basic mystery. Why does all of this processing in the brain give you a first person point of view? And I think, you know, every now and then an ambitious neuroscientist writes a book, you know, claiming to solve the problem. But I don't think even most neuroscientists have been too convinced by that so far.
Now, is the big question whether there are certain aspects of consciousness that have no neural correlates in the brain?
Not exactly. I mean, it's really taken for granted by most people in this area, including me, that there will be very strong correlations between the brain and consciousness. So, you know, a certain area of your brain lights up, you get some consciousness that goes along with it. What we're looking for, though, is something more than correlation. I think what we're looking for is explanation, some kind of explanation of how it is that when you put all these bits together in the brain and set up such a, you know, complicated circuit and so on, why does that give you consciousness? And if we just leave it at the level of correlation, yeah, well, this brain process lights up, consciousness lights up, that falls very far short of an explanation. It doesn't tell us, for example, whether consciousness just is the brain process or whether consciousness is something completely separate, which is correlated with the brain process.
Now, you are best known for making the distinction between what you have called the hard and easy problems of consciousness. Can you explain the difference?
Yeah, so this goes back to a conference, one of the maybe the first really big international conference on consciousness about 16 years ago in Tucson, Arizona, which I went along to. And I thought, well, just for the first few minutes of the I gave a talk there for the first few minutes, I thought I'll just set up what the problems are, because different people, when they talk about consciousness at these events, the word consciousness is so ambiguous. It means so many different things to different people. So let's just separate out a few of the problems. The easy problems, as I called them then, were problems, roughly speaking, tied to objective behavior and to the mechanisms that produce them. So the difference between, say, being awake and responsive versus being asleep and unresponsive. That's something you can characterize from the third-person point of view, and maybe there'll be a neural, brain-based solution to that, or the problem of how it is that you respond to a given stimulus that you see. And maybe the brain integrates information about it, you produce a verbal report. That's also one of the, quote, easy problems, in the sense that although we still don't, there's still a whole lot about that we don't understand, there's no great mystery about seeing how it is that a brain process could bring about that behavior. The hard problem has always been the problem of how is it that all this processing in the brain gives rise to first-person subjective experience, you know, the feeling of seeing, of hearing, this inner movie that we have in our mind when we perceive, when we think, when we feel, when we remember. I mean, there's something it's like to be us as human beings. And the hard problem is basically, why does all this processing in the brain give us this bizarre first person, something it's like from the inside?
I've always wondered about where our thoughts come from. Not that we have the ability to think, but that seemingly random thoughts pop into our heads. Is this a hard problem or an easy problem?
It's got elements of both insofar as the thoughts have a conscious aspect. It feels like something to think from the first person point of view. But if you're dealing with the question of where did a particular thought come from, you know, why did today you think about, some event that happened in your childhood, and why tomorrow are you going to think about, you know, your mother? I'd guess I'd put that on the side of the easy problems, in the sense that we could imagine there's eventually going to be a brain-based or, computer-based solution to this, in terms of, hey, there are certain memories in your brain, and there are certain associations, and something triggers the thought about your mother. Or maybe it's just random, and there's random selection of all the memory information you have. So I guess I'd think that's a really interesting and difficult problem, but it's not, you know, officially on the side of the hard problem of consciousness.
It's interesting because it also gets to the question of what we would associate with creativity. For instance, the novelist who is creating a story and characters out of her imagination, or a jazz musician who riffs on a tune to make it his own. Are you saying these are easy problems ultimately?
Well, I'd say that, I mean, creativity and creative processes do involve a really distinctive, interesting, conscious experience, you know, the experience that the jazz musician is getting into while they're being musically creative. At the same time, though, I think, you know, there are complex and simple forms of consciousness. And in a way, the core of the hard problem of consciousness is posed just as strongly by far simpler states than, you know, creativity and complex thought. You can pose the hard problem of consciousness just by thinking about something as simple as feeling a pain. You know, I pinch myself and, oh, okay, that, you know, that hurt a bit. Why did it? Now I can tell a story about how it is that that sent a signal up my nerves, the brain, stimulated pain areas of the brain. But why did this have that distinctive first-person experience of hurting? Now, there's nothing especially creative or complex about that, but it still poses the hard problem. Of course, the forms of consciousness that come up in creativity or complex thought are all the more, you know, strange and mysterious. But I think the core problem even arises from the simple cases.
So why is this hard problem of consciousness so hard? I mean, why is it so hard for science, for neuroscience, for cognitive science to explain this subjective experience, this first-person experience?
Well, one way to think about it is that science is set up from the start to be objective. And we're only comfortable with things in science when they're sort of fully objective. We have objective mechanisms, measurable from the third-person point of view. We gather our data intersubjectively. Every scientist can access the phenomena the same. We can all make the same measurements and so on. And that's how science is meant to be. But consciousness, and that works so well in physics, biology, even some areas of the science of the mind. But consciousness, by its nature, is subjective. It's all about subjective experience from the first-person point of view. It's not something you can directly measure from the outside. I mean, I don't even know for sure when I'm talking to you that you're conscious. I believe you are. I take what you say as some kind of evidence for it, but I can't measure it directly. We can only get at it indirectly. And the kinds of mechanistic explanation we get to in science in terms of explaining what it is that systems do just don't seem to work so well for this essentially subjective phenomenons. So when I think about this, science is basically all about gathering what we might call third-person data, traditionally, data equally accessible to everyone. Consciousness really involves what we might think of as first-person data.
Basically, data if you want to know about my mind, I have to tell you about it.
Roughly, yeah, that's basically right. You know for sure about your consciousness. I know for sure about my own consciousness. And then we can communicate it to each other by telling each other. And verbal report is, in fact, the method which is used the most in the science of consciousness. But it still makes people uncomfortable because, you know, we're only getting at the phenomenon fairly indirectly. And, you know, you can do and to explain things like the verbal report isn't to actually explain the state of consciousness itself. I mean, it's one thing to explain why you say ow. It's another thing to explain that feeling of pain that underlies your saying ow.
Now, are these questions about consciousness also related to questions about what the self is, what it means to be me, for instance?
I'd say they're very closely connected. I mean, any self that we think of, as any system that we think of as deserving the name self or person would have to be a conscious system. I think if there wasn't a first-person perspective, if it didn't feel like something to be a system, that system couldn't have a self. Maybe there's simple forms of consciousness which are, I think maybe flies have a simple form of consciousness. I don't know whether we want to say they have a self. One thing we might say is they're certainly not conscious of themselves. So one thing that we have as human beings is we have a self, we have consciousness. We also have this consciousness of ourselves as selves. And that may be something that makes human consciousness distinctive. But on the other hand, consciousness itself, and maybe even self itself, maybe flies can be said to have a primitive sort of self and a primitive sort of consciousness. They're just not conscious of themselves.
Hmm. Are you talking about the limits of materialism? I mean, the idea that the mental is nothing more than brain mechanics. Is that part of your critique here?
It is, yes. You know, one of the big issues in the philosophy of the mind is, well, is the mind just the brain? I mean, are physical processes enough to explain what's in your mind and what's in your consciousness? And I've been, you know, somewhat reluctantly led to the conclusion by the sorts of considerations we've been talking about that, in fact, materialism doesn't have the resources to fully explain consciousness. So that to fully explain consciousness, you have to expand your basic furniture of science from beyond the resources of just, say, physics. I mean, the materialist view says basically there's a few fundamental properties in the world, space and time and mass and charge, and a few laws that connect them, and everything can ultimately be explained in terms of that, physics to chemistry.
Everything in chemistry, biology, ultimately can be reduced to the properties
right.
of physics.
Right, so you get this great chain of being in a way from physics upward. But my own view is that although this works so well in chemistry and biology and so on, for the reasons we've been talking about, when it comes to consciousness, this reductionist program doesn't succeed. And at this point, we should just, rather than saying, we could just say, oh, it's a giant mystery. But I think at this point, what we should say is, well, what you do in science is, Occam's razor says, don't multiply entities without necessity. But, you know, in this case, there is necessity. I think it's basically, what's happening here is something is telling us we need more primitives in our ontology, so to speak. It's not just space, time, mass, and charge. So my own view is we should take something like consciousness as a primitive element of the world, a fundamental property, if you like, in the way that physics takes space and time and mass and charge.
Now, that's fascinating. I mean, you're suggesting that consciousness may have its own fundamental property of nature, so to speak?
But basically, yes. Yeah, I mean, consciousness or maybe some other weird property, some other weird new property, proto-consciousness, which could somehow produce consciousness. But we do need to expand the ontology of fundamental properties. That's my view. It's, you know, physics is meant to be a theory of everything, fundamental properties that explains everything. But if it turns out it doesn't explain everything, then I think what we have to do as scientists is to expand our primitives.
So what would that fundamental property of consciousness be?
Well, at this point, we really don't know. So I mean, we're really in the realm of speculation, and I get to do this speculation because I'm a philosopher, but I can't say we're not remotely close yet to the point where we have the details of a theory. I mean, I'll be happy if we have it in 50 years, you know, it could be 200 years. But one thought is just, you know, some certain basic aspects of consciousness, certain primitive dimensions of consciousness. I mean, analogies maybe are work here. Color seems like this big complex experience, but we could break down color into a few primitive dimensions, hue, saturation, brightness, from which you can get all the properties of color that we seem to experience. Well, maybe it will turn out there are 4 or 5 primitive dimensions of consciousness so that we can break down, you know, the complex, multifaceted, multisensory consciousness that we have and see how that could be the property of the, you know, the resultant of, you know, 4 or 5 basic properties of consciousness put together in the right configurations. I mean, at the moment, this is just, it's just speculation, but that's, you might, what we basically, just as in physics, you've got fundamental laws that connect these fundamental properties to each other. For a fundamental theory of consciousness, in my view, what you need is a theory that connects these fundamental physical properties like space, time, charge, and so on to consciousness, roughly telling you when you've got a physical system of these properties, you'll get a conscious system with these properties, and this is what its consciousness will be like. We don't have that theory yet, but if we did, maybe that would be a theory of consciousness.
Well, I want to push you to speculate a little bit more. And you have suggested that maybe information is this fundamental property that's somehow connected to consciousness. And I know there are some scientists out there, including some physicists, who say that maybe information is actually the most primary, most fundamental property of all. How far are you willing to run with that?
Yeah, so in a book I wrote in 96, The Conscious Mind, I speculated a fair amount about information maybe being the key concept, and that basically you've got information embodied physically, and physics can somehow be seen as a giant informational process, you know, bits affecting other bits and so on. And then we add the other fundamental postulate that wherever you find information, then it has, information basically has two aspects. And the other aspect is a conscious aspect. So physical information will correlate then with experienced conscious information, and that would kind of have the status of a fundamental law in the system. And so what we do find in our conscious visual experience is, you know, a big, it's kind of like a, you know, it's a computer monitor, right? With you've got a big pixels, color pixels spread out in space over a visual field. You can see all that as a giant information structure that corresponds, somehow it's a projection of the information structure in your brain. So my thought then was maybe we could use this to build a theory around. Now, I've got to say that I haven't gotten a whole lot further with those ideas about information than I was about 14 years ago. And I'm inclined to think it's a bit early to be really building the details of a theory around them. But that's the kind of speculation that points at least towards some interesting ideas for how a theory might eventually go.
And let's just play with this for a moment. Wouldn't information have to be made of something or consist of something? You can't just talk about information itself, can you?
It's a really good question. It is certainly, you know, if you look at your average computer or phone line or place where information is, it's always realized by something, you know, voltage circuits in a computer or electricity. Some people have suggested that maybe there's a fundamental level of information that isn't realized by anything more primitive than itself. It's just basic bits, ones and zeros. It's just two states which are different from each other. And it's not that there's something else that makes that difference. It's not that, you know, it's like red versus blue or on versus off. It's just, you know, two different bits. So the physicist John Wheeler called this idea it from bit. Rather than getting bits, information from some underlying level of it, you know, like voltages. In fact, everything in the world is built on this level of pure information. I don't know. The idea is a bit crazy, and that's, you know, it's not totally clear that it makes sense to think of pure information, but I at least find that it's sort of an attractive speculation. If you want to have a level of matter or something underlying your information, I think you can have that here as well. And then we'll just say the information is embodied in matter. It's also embodied in consciousness.
Now, I know there are a few renegade scientists who think we need quantum physics to explain consciousness. What do you think?
There are a lot of intriguing connections between quantum physics and consciousness. I mean, my first reaction is, well, it's not obvious how you get from classical physics to consciousness, you know, but it's not at all obvious how bringing in quantum mechanics helps. I mean, you've got, say, so Roger Penrose and my odd colleague Stuart Hameroff at Arizona. They think that the key to consciousness is all about the collapse of wave functions by quantum gravity mechanisms in microtubules inside the brain. But then, you know, there's a basic natural question to arise here is, well, we didn't know how processing in neurons will give you consciousness. It's just there was an explanatory gap, if you like. Well, it looks like there's exactly the same explanatory gap between, you know, a wave function collapses in microtubules and consciousness. At this point, though, some people are led to think that quantum mechanics might have a special role in a theory because there are versions of quantum mechanics that actually take consciousness as fundamental, as primitive, and give it a role. So there's a version of quantum mechanics that says, you know, wave functions collapse every now and then. They go from a very spread out state to a determinate state. Schrödinger's cat goes from being both alive and dead to being, say, alive. When does this happen? It happens when someone makes a measurement. What's a measurement? Well, that's basically when a system impacts on someone's consciousness. So there's a version of quantum mechanics that says basically consciousness is what collapses the wave function. This takes consciousness as primitive and gives it a role. And since one of the big questions around here is, if consciousness is this primitive, what's its role in the physical world? Does it make a difference? Quantum mechanics, at least I think, has something interesting, an interesting speculative thought about what that role could be.
But it seems like the problem with that is if you sort of take it to its absurd conclusion, nothing would happen if someone doesn't think about it.
It's an interesting question, yeah. Just say you already get consciousness in complex systems, and just say those very complex systems took, you know, billions of years to evolve, as we currently think they did. And on this view, well, what happened to the universe for those first few billion years when nobody was conscious? I guess the universe must have evolved in a big, giant superposition of every possible state on the wave function. And then at a certain point in one of these branches of the wave function, evolution got to the point where the first glimmer of consciousness came in there and got affected. And then at that point, the whole wave function collapsed. And human and evolutionary history became determinate. So yeah, it is a pretty weird and wild view. But one thing we've learned from quantum mechanics is there's no way to understand quantum mechanics without it being a weird and wild view.
Now, in some ways, your views, for instance, your willingness to entertain this connection between consciousness and quantum physics is it would seem to resonate with people with a spiritual or religious bent, because they always say that the mind cannot be reduced simply to neural correlates. Is there a spiritual component to your perspective?
Not for me personally. I mean, I'm not a religious person at all. I guess I'm an atheist. I've got my average watered down, you know, academic humanist spirituality, if you like, but nothing more than that. I do find these views do tend to resonate quite often with people with religious backgrounds, whether it's, say, a Christian background, or quite often, you know, things like Buddhism and their ideas in Buddhism and other Eastern religions that some people find it resonating with. You know, consciousness is primitive, consciousness is the ground of all being. And that would, I guess that's okay with me, but I'm just very cautious about drawing too direct a connection. I've been led to these views just by thinking about these things from a relatively objective, scientific, and philosophical perspective. Some people think that the only reason you might want to be to have views like this is for broadly religious and spiritual reasons. That's not the case at all.
And I think there's a specific reason for that. Those people with these religious views would say that there's something about consciousness that goes beyond the individual person. There's some way that, you know, my mind can tap into some larger cosmic mind.
Yeah, maybe that's what they think. Or maybe they're motivated by thoughts of life after death. That, you know, there could be, if consciousness is something separate from the body, then maybe that gives some solace to people who think that, you know, our consciousness may go on after our bodies are dead. All I can say is, I've got no evidence about life after death, and the view that I've put forward doesn't make any particular predictions about that. My own view is it's probably, sad but true, when my body dies, my consciousness will either die or dissolve or fragment along with it. But I guess it's the case that if people want to find, if you are inclined to believe in, say, non-physical souls, which I'm not, but if you are inclined to believe in something like a soul, you could take elements of the picture I'm putting forward here and sort of graft the soul onto it. I just want to say that's not compulsory. I mean, that's going way, way beyond where the science or the philosophy takes you. So I guess, although I've got some, maybe some fairly radical views in some sense, I want to be conservative about it and say, well, this is where the arguments and the evidence take you. Anything beyond that is really speculation.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you are describing an impasse here, perhaps an insoluble problem for people who study the mind. This whole business of subjective experience, of where it comes from, is there a future to figuring this out?
Well, you know, the funny thing is, despite everything we've been saying, the science of consciousness has just gone from strength to strength over the last 15, 20 years. You know, when I was a graduate student around 1990, almost nobody was working on consciousness in neuroscience, in psychology, even in philosophy. It was a bit of a fringe topic.
Which is fascinating because, I mean, in some ways you'd think this is the greatest mystery there is, and yet up until fairly recently, no one was actually studying it.
I think people didn't really know how to deal with it. It was just this, you know, it's like the crazy aunt in the attic, as someone put it. Well, how do we deal with it? So one thing that changed was in the 1990s, people started figuring out some relatively rigorous ways to study the neural correlates of consciousness. So neuroscientists became interested in consciousness. Even without solving the hard problem, giving a theory of consciousness, they could do experiments that taught us this bit of the brain is correlating with your visual experience of consciousness, this one's not. And that's really gotten us places. Likewise, other things have happened in psychology and in neurology. And so on. So the science is really getting places. I think it's fair to say, okay, no one's yet solved the hard problem. So I suppose that's remaining an impasse. And I do think there will probably, like most of the great problems of philosophy never get completely solved for once and for all. There's probably going to remain arguments about these things even in hundreds of years. Still, I'm inclined to be an optimist. And my own view is we're not that close yet to exploring the space of possible theories. And once we've got a whole lot more evidence from brain sciences and a whole lot more philosophical thought and a whole lot more theory development, then there's room for a whole space of theories that we haven't gotten to yet.
What would that take? I mean, how do you get to this next level of somehow cracking the nut of subjective experience?
Well, here's my view for what we need to do. It's basically, we gather data. We gather third-person data about the brain and behavior. That's your average thing from neuroscience. But we also need to get very good at gathering first-person data, basically measuring our own conscious experiences from the inside, introspect them, catalog their properties, develop language for representing and systematizing our conscious experiences, and then do a science which consists of sort of, roughly speaking, bringing the third-person data and the first-person data together, saying, formulate a hypothesis. When you have this third-person state, you then get this state of consciousness. I mean, this is already happening now in a very basic way with the study of neural correlates of consciousness, but we just need something much more general, powerful, and systematic. We're not there yet. But eventually, you could imagine, we'll be led to boil down that connection to some really simple and powerful underlying connections between physical processes and consciousness. You know, when you have this kind of information physically, you get this kind of conscious state, and ultimately be led to, you know, your fundamental laws of consciousness, still taking consciousness as a primitive, but connecting it to the other primitives. And for me, that would be a theory.
Yeah. But I can see, for instance, that, you know, if you do a lot of MRI studies, I mean, functional MRI studies, and, you know, have people then report what they've been thinking and, you know, match that with brainwaves. I mean, certainly you can construct a fairly exact science of correlation, I would think. But can you ever get to the causal mechanism of what actually generates those experiences? I mean, can you imagine a way that could ever happen?
Well, on my view, this parallels an issue which comes up in thinking about physics. Wherever you have a fundamental law in physics, something is kind of taken for granted. So Newton came up with his laws of gravitation and so on. They said, okay, well, you've got this thing here, this action at a distance. You know, things with a certain mass attract each other. But how does it happen? What's the mechanism? Well, some things just get taken as primitive. And in Newton's theory, that was the law of gravitation. So that's just how it is with fundamental laws in science. Now, we're not used to doing that outside of physics. But if I'm right, then in this case of consciousness, we have to do something a bit like that here too. You know, there's just going to be there are going to be primitives in the physics and primitives in the consciousness, and we'll have a fundamental law that connects them, whatever that is. And then that will just have to be taken as a primitive in our theory in the way that the law of gravity is. And then looking for a mechanism for why is that law? You can always ask, why is that a law of nature? And that's at the point where we kind of throw up our hands, and science just doesn't have very much to say about why we live in a universe with the laws of nature that we have. We just would say that's primitive. I mean, maybe someone could explain that, but that's really getting into the realm of very deep cosmic speculation.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the computers of the future, presumably far more advanced than the computers of today, will be conscious?
Yeah, I don't see why not. I don't see what's special about human biology. I mean, it's hard to see how silicon chips will give you consciousness, but it's also hard to see how neurons will give you consciousness. I don't see a difference in principle. Maybe you could replace the neurons in a brain gradually by silicon chips. You know, a quarter of your brain is replaced, half your brain is replaced. We might eventually upload the whole thing. And, you know, my own view is that there's some reason to think that consciousness might be preserved in this process. One thing we know is if the computer processes are good enough simulations of neurons, we'll at least be left with a system which tells us, hey, I'm conscious. Because, you know, after all, that's what we were doing before. If it's a good simulation, it will say that later. Now, so the only question is whether your consciousness gradually disappeared as you underwent this replacement process. I mean, you know, we can never rule that out completely, but I'm inclined to think that computers can be conscious. And in fact, I've been thinking about this a lot in another context lately, of thinking about what happens when computers become more intelligent than human beings. Will there then be sort of super intelligence and, you know, super consciousness that goes far beyond our kind of consciousness?
What do you think? Do you think that'll happen?
I think it's a possibility. You know, people talk about the singularity, this moment when computers get more artificially designed. We design computers that are smarter than we are, then they'll be better than us, presumably, at designing computers. So they'll be able to design computers which are smarter than the best computers we can design and which are therefore smarter than themselves. So you repeat this process, you get computers designing ever smarter computers, and before long you're left with something like super intelligence. And I don't see why something like this shouldn't happen. The question then is, where do we stand in this process? Maybe we should be sort of uploading and upgrading ourselves throughout the whole process, so that, you know, the super intelligent beings are not, so to speak, our masters, but are us. There are different paths to artificial intelligence, starting from the brain and uploading and upgrading or creating something new. Maybe it's a slightly happier scenario for humans if we start from the brain.
It does raise the question of what it means for a computer to be smarter. Obviously, a computer has far higher capacity for information processing.
Yeah.
But is that what smarter really means? I mean, are there some qualities of the human brain that will always elude what computers can do?
Yeah, so it's got to be a lot more than just information processing or memory or speed and so on. Although those things are at least relevant to intelligence. If I just do something twice as fast, that counts. We often count that as being in some sense smarter. But I mean, things like creativity have to be in there, insights, flexibility, all the things which current computers are terrible at. You know, right now, computers have very good memory and processing capacity, but not much in the way of insight, not much in the way of creativity, not much in the way of flexibility. Still, I don't see why those things have to be, in principle, obstacles forever. I mean, presumably, if someone could simulate a whole brain, and if the brain is what's actually producing the behavior, then they could that could, in principle, be built into a computer. Now, not soon, probably, maybe not for 100 years. But the question is there something about human information processing that couldn't be built into a computer? And, you know, despite what I say about consciousness, I don't yet see any reason to think that at least the process, just here we're just talking about the easy problems, you know, intelligence, I'm understanding in behavioral terms. I don't see any reason to think a computer couldn't have that. Then, of course, there's the further question. If it did, just say it did have all this intelligent or super intelligent behavior, would it be conscious? And, of course, that's a further question. You know, you might say we'd be left with super intelligent zombie computers, wonderful behavioral capacities, no consciousness at all. But my own view is that there's at least this correlation between information processing in physical systems and information processing in consciousness, so that probably if you did have this super intelligent information processing, you'd most likely have some kind of bizarre super consciousness that went along with it.
Of course, there's also a great philosophical question, which is, could we just be all living in some simulated computer? Could we be living in the Matrix?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a great question, which I've thought a fair amount about. You might think that there's actually some reason to take this seriously. After all, simulation technology is getting better and better. People, we have got, you know, Sim Earth, Sim City, Sim Life, The Sims. Pretty soon there's going to be Sim Universe. Everyone's going to be running copies of Sim Universe in the background on their desktop. There's going to be, eventually the simulations will be really good. There'll be, you know, everyone will be running a simulation with thousands or billions of simulated people. There'll be way more simulated people in the universe than original people. Then you sit back and think, well, what are the odds that I'm one of the ones at level zero, you know, one of the people running the simulations. The odds, so many more simulated people, the chances are maybe you and I are among them.
So you consider this as a serious possibility. I mean, this is not just something to laugh away.
I do, actually, yeah. I mean, I think we'll probably eventually create the simulated universes. We'll be able to see those people going through conversations just like this one. And then it's going to make us sit back and think, well, is this telling us something about ourselves? I don't know that we're in a simulation, but I think this does make it a hypothesis we should at least take seriously. You know, worlds, within worlds, some, you know, simulated worlds within other simulated worlds. I guess from the movie we know about the matrix within a matrix. Then the philosopher's question is, if that's true, well, what does that mean? You know, some people think that if it turns out we're in a simulation, none of this is real. We're just the victims of a grand delusion and all of this is just fake. So my own view is, no, that's if we are in a simulation, well, that's very interesting, but it doesn't turn the world around us into an illusion. It just tells us something about the nature of the world around us. It turns out we're living in a giant, you know, the metaphysics of it. There are still tables and there are still chairs and there are still people. It's just there's an underlying metaphysics which is fundamentally computational or informational. So actually it plays quite well into the ideas we were talking about before of a world of information. If we're in a matrix, we're in a world of information, but it's still, in its way, perfectly real.
That is a perfect place to end it. Thank you so much.
Great, thanks. It's been a pleasure.